Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome again to The Hobcast, episode number 35, I believe.
Yes, I think it is 35, yeah.
I say that every week as if I don't know.
I know, and you always expect me to know, and I think, is it? Yes, I'm sure it is,
Welcome to the show, and this week's guest on The Hobcast Book Show is Brian Price, who is another Hoback author with his debut crime novel, published by us later this week. In fact, Tuesday, what would it be, 14th?
14th of September, Fatal Trade.
Fatal Trade, the name of the book. It's fantastic, but of course, Brian is also widely known in crime circles for his scientific expertise, so we'll delve into that a little bit later. Now, this is not the most pristine audio environment we've ever used before.
No, but it's one of my favourite places that I used to come to as a child.
And that is Knutsford Services on the M6 and the northbound traffic thundering underneath us. And I'll get excited if we see any sort of VW combi vans, which are my favourites. Then I sort of saw one just a moment ago, but I'll get very excited. But we are staring down the driver's throats as they thunder underneath us as we make our way back from a little jaunt north to see one of our authors, Ollie Jarvis.
Yeah, so we had coffee in Ollie Jarvis's garden this morning, didn't we? And we were visiting him because we delivered the rest of his advanced copies of the Genesis Inquiry, which is due in October, publishing in October.
So that was one reason I went to see family as well. So that's been our Sunday after another busy week. But let's do the introductions properly. The Hobcast Book Show is from Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following genres:
thrillers,
crime,
mystery,
suspense.
Did you see what I did there? I was being the cars.
Going... That was really good, yeah. You've got the, what's the Doppler effect, isn't
it?
Yeah. Yeah, and we've just been watching the F1, so if you haven't seen the result, Lewis and Max crashed into each other, which is all very dramatic, and no doubt your boys will be banging on about it for the rest of the week.
Is Max Verstappen okay?
He's fine. He crashed into Lewis. It's all his fault, as far as
but
I could tell.
Lewis Hastings is writing a book. He can't be in a crash.
Lewis Hamilton.
Oh, Hamilton.
Yeah, don't worry about that. And we're still flush with the corporate success of Emma Raducanu winning the US Open, which we stayed up most of the week, including 4 a.m. for a semi-final to watch. What an astonishing achievement. So congratulations to her. Let's talk about news, though, in the publishing world.
I suppose this isn't just the publishing world's news item that caught my eye. It's about the HG drivers and just the issues with supply, and this is affecting the publishing industry as well, because obviously people are ordering books and they're not getting books as quick as they used to, because the drivers can't drive the books quick enough. Well, there's not enough drivers to drive the books.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if you're going to favour one product over another, it's going to be fuel and food over books, really.
And my concern is, will this affect printing schedules as well? Because, you know, some of our books are printed in Milton Keynes. Some of them are now being printed in Suffolk. So, you know, they have to be transported to the various bookshops and to us as well. I've got this sort of element of concern about this, that this will affect us as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it tends to downwash into our world too, even though we're obviously not as reliant on big print runs as the major publishers and the major bookshops. So it is a concern, that's for sure. When has a book signing cost £40 million?
I'm gonna guess I don't know, JK Rowling or Richard Osman, someone like that.
Well, no. This week the fifth and final test between England and India was called off. It should be played at Old Trafford in Manchester. starting a couple of days ago, and it got called off because four members of the Indian management and backroom staff caught COVID, including Ravi Shastri, the coach. And it's now thought, or at least that's one theory being put forward, that the whole team and all the backroom staff went to Ravi Shastri's book launch, and 150 members of the public also attended. There were no COVID protocols whatsoever. And so it could be, I mean, the cost of the loss of this match to English cricket is about 40 million quid. Huge disaster for Lancashire County Cricket Club. For all the suppliers, the beer suppliers, the food suppliers, it's just horrendous.
Well, it's sort of the ripple effect, isn't it, of something like this. You wouldn't think so much about the people who've taken time off work. And like you say, the, you know, suppliers of all the food and the drink and hotels as well, all that sort of thing. It's all just gone.
Yeah, because the players, although they didn't test positive, were concerned that because the team's physios had tested positive, they were getting a catch-up, basically. And then they would be stuck in this country for a few days extra as well.
You can understand their concern.
Yeah, and they've got to start playing the Indian Premier League, which is a vastly lucrative tournament in 5 days' time. Anyway, so that is probably the world's most expensive book launch.
Yes. So, yeah, I suppose we've got three items in Juve, haven't we? Britain winning US Open female singles and something about cricket and the drivers.
Interesting thing with Emma Raducanu. I read one of the articles. I mean, I've been obsessed with reading anything about her the last week or so, that she's shelving plans to go to university.
Oh, really?
For now. Yeah, because she was lining up. She wants to be a barrister.
I didn't know that. That's actually quite interesting. Yeah.
Obviously, she's got the 2A levels. She got fantastic grades in earlier in the summer and was lining up to go to university to study law. But she's now a millionaire-ess with essentially almost unlimited earning power in terms of sponsorships. You know, she's bright. She's incredibly charismatic. She's extremely talented. She's funny. You know, this hopefully doesn't sound
like... You are describing me, right?
Yeah. Look, I'm, you know, and let's face it, she's also very, very good looking.
You're still describing me.
All of those things. She speaks Mandarin, which means that she opens up the Chinese market.
Damn it. That's where the similarities end.
She's a marketeer's dream, and she's just done something that, you know, is quite extraordinary. To repeat the two big salient statistics... First ever qualifier to win a Grand Slam tennis tournament, which means she won 10 matches in a row to win the title, and she is also the only player to win a Grand Slam without dropping a set.
Well, they are two very big statistics, but the one I like is the fact she was the first British woman to be in a final or win a final. Virginia Wade did
1977.
Yeah, so I like that.
Yeah, all amazing at the age of 18. Extraordinary. Well, I don't think Brian can claim to have those sort of statistics when we talk to Brian Price.
We don't know if Brian plays tennis.
He might do. No, he has written a superb debut crime novel, Fatal Trade, which we were bowled over by when we got it. And this builds on his contribution to the wider crime writing community in this country as a scientific consultant. He used to work for the Environment Agency at one stage, and if you need something checking out in terms of science in your novels, forensics, that sort of thing, he's your man.
Lewis Hastings, we know you're listening because we know you go for a walk with your dog and you listen to us. We're going to give the chemist to Brian to check the science in your book.
Yeah.
Not that we don't believe you, but Brian has got an absolutely sharp eagle eye on anything to do with chemistry. So
we don't doubt you for a moment, Lewis.
No,
but you know, nice to be reassured that you got it right. Okay, let's talk to Brian Price. Brian Price, thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast, and congratulations, a big week with the publication of Fatal Trade.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to actually seeing it in bookshops and the like.
So are we. I mean, this is always the exciting bit, I think, for everyone involved, is the after all the negotiations and all the work that goes into it. And I was just flicking through your acknowledgements. So a lot of people have contributed towards getting you here.
But let's start by just filling in a few of the blanks in terms of what people may or may not know about you. You've written before, but not in the crime genre.
Oh, yeah, I was an environmental consultant for a number of years, and I did some work for Friends of the Earth and people like that. So I think the first book was The Friends of the Earth Guide to Pollution, which came out in about 1981, I think, a slim volume summarising what the situation with pollution was at the time. It did quite well, but it's very, very dated. I then wrote a book with a friend called C for Chemicals on household chemicals and what the hazards were. And this was following the E for additives sort of meme, if you like, and then did P for pollution, which was a more up-to-date and larger paperback. But after that, most of my writing was technical reports on things like energy from waste and clean power and what have you, for a business information unit based at the Financial Times. So it was not your sort of Smith's paperbacks. They were sort of hefty things which retailed at about 300 quid a pop. But that was, you know, the terms of published writing. I've also had pieces in The Guardian, New Scientist, and some of my work at the Environment Agency involved writing and editing what other people had done.
So plenty, you know, you know how to, you know, put words down. That's before you became a crime writer. But what about the inspiration that made you a crime writer? I mean, I'm picking up that Crime Fest plays a big part in that switch.
Yeah, that's right. The Environment Agency offices were opposite Bristol Central Library, and I used to sort of haunt the place in my lunchtime. And on one occasion, I came across this small poster stuck on a pillar saying Crime Fest for authors and readers of crime fiction. It was being held in a hotel just down the road. So I looked online, got one of the last tickets available, and turned up because it looked like a fun weekend. I was half expecting the crime writers to be on a bit of a pedestal and, you know, distant from everybody else. But in fact, I found everybody really approachable. There was sort of Ian Rankin in the bar having a drink with everybody else and people swapping anecdotes and tales and so on. Authors meeting fans, signing books, and really it was a tremendous atmosphere. So I thought, yeah, this is fun. Maybe I could get involved somehow. Well, I'm a scientist by trade, if you like. And I often got annoyed by mistakes people made in crime fiction with things like chloroform and drugs and firearms and so on. So I set up this little website with a few basic tips on some of the mistakes to avoid. And my wife suggested I turned it into a book, which I duly did. And the result was Crime Writing, How to Write the Science, which the academic publisher Study Mates put out. It's been very well received by crime writers, a lot of whom have found it useful. And I do advise them on a sort of separate basis. If people want something looked at or a question answered, I always try and help. But then I thought, well, you know, this is fun. I'm meeting all these crime writers writing fiction. Could I do something like that? So the idea fermented for a while. And then the Crime Fiction Coach Facebook group ran a competition for the best first sentence to start a crime novel. And I won. I won some chocolates and a 3 a.m. notebook. And somebody said that they couldn't wait to read the story. Well, with that, I didn't have any option. I had to write the book, didn't I? So that's what I did. And the result after, you know, numerous tries with agents and so on is that I was delighted when Rebecca said she liked it and Hoback Books agreed to publish it. So that's where we are.
That's where we are. I think, you know, now you've mentioned it, we're going to have to.
Yeah, we do have
to. We're going to have to preview the first line.
The first line.
Okay, not quite the first line.
Well, the first line
of chapter one.
Yeah.
Which we're, yeah. Okay.
I hadn't written a prologue or anything, but I thought that was a good way of starting. And then.
That's right. So there's a prologue now. But in chapter one, the first line of Fatal Trade by Brian Price, which is a DC Mel Cotton thriller. We'll talk about DC Mel Cotton a little bit later. But here it is. The small, grey-haired woman grimaced as she entered the police station, dragging a tartan shopping trolley containing her husband's head. That's brilliant. And then it goes on. I'm going to read just one more line. What are you useless buggers going to do about this? She demanded, reaching into the trolley and heaving a cardboard box onto the counter.
Which hence the cover image.
I love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, I was gripped from the first line. And yeah, it's an absolute zinger.
Are you saying you just came up with a line with no idea where that line was going to go? It was just you thought this would be a great line for a book?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of dabbled at short stories and not had a huge amount of success. But I was thinking of doing something a bit different from a kind of locked room, whodunit kind of thing. And I just had this image initially of this elderly lady pulling a shopping trolley with her husband's head in it. And that led to all kinds of possibilities. I had no idea where the story was going to go. And I sort of parked it and then fiddled with the sentence and sent it in for this competition. But it could have been that she had killed him and was suffering from dementia and was sort of wandering across the traffic lights on red, and you know, the cars stopped and she was taken away and arrested. It could be that, as it turned out, it's a sort of grim warning from somebody. Could be that she didn't even know it was in there until she got to the supermarket and suddenly, trying to pour our spuds in the shopping trolley, found there was something already in there. They could have gone in all sorts of directions, but once I started writing it and got it into the police station and the reaction of the police officers and the civilian support staff, I thought, well, yeah, it's got to be something like a warning or a threat or something. And that's the way it developed.
I think what's so wonderful about it is it's dark, but it's also comic in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's the absurdity of the situation, but I'm sure there must be police officers out there who face something similar to that. You know, and actually I think anyone in public service of that type, the emergency services, gets pretty used to seeing heads.
I know I did as a journalist.
Well, I saw it once as a... I beg to differ, because if someone goes through a windscreen, that tends to be what happens. So I've seen that when I went to a road traffic accident before everyone got there, which was horrible.
But I just thought that'd be a great idea for a crime writing competition, wouldn't it? Give everybody the first line, any first lines. Give them a winning first line, and they all have to go off and write from that and see what they come up with.
Maybe that's the thing for this Christmas.
Oh, it's too late for this anthology. Christmas. Next Christmas.
Next Christmas anthology. Right. Actually, we could do it as a chain
thing. You're right, Adrian. Anybody in the sort of blue light trade is going to come across a lot of very grisly things, whether it's charred corpses, RTCs, and the people scattered across the motorway, or just the general sort of mayhem people inflict on each other after too many bevvies, and the paramedics have to sweep up the mess. So, yeah, you have to be a very special person to cope with this, I think. And
I think that's true. I mean, my mum and my sister both nurses, and they've got a lot of grim stories.
Yeah.
And I was the opposite. I was very squeamish as a child.
Well, that has killed the conversation. No.
Getting back to less bloody topics, yes.
Just thinking of all the sort of severed heads and limbs.
No, well,
and...
you know, we're talking about crime. And actually, you know, I've just been reading another of your Hobeck contemporaries' latest novel, The Chemist, by, actually, which needs to go through your hands, I think.
Yes, we need you to read
Lewis Hastings, which has a lot of detailed science in it. But again, you know, there's this sense within the team, the Orion team that he has created with Jack Cade at the head of it, with Jason Roberts and all that sort of thing, that they deal with these horrific situations on a regular basis. And what gets them through is a sort of camaraderie and a dark humour.
That's like quite interesting, because Lewis, he mentioned just last week that somebody had criticised him and they said, well, your books are full of banter. Why are they full of banter? You're dealing with these very serious, dark themes. And Lewis replied with, you know, but that's real life. That's what it's like when you're working with these, you know, very serious, quite dark and macabre things. Macabre, I mean.
I think he said, presumably you've never served in the forces or something. But yeah, gallows humour keeps you going, whether you're a pathologist or a detective attending post-mortems or the aftermath of fights. So people do make jokes which you would think are very callous, but it's really a protective mechanism.
In terms of your working life, I mean, being an environmental scientist and, you know, dealing with pollution, I mean, you must have seen some things that were, you know, from the point of view of having empathy for the environment, some terrible things. Because I know I've been to a couple of spillages in my time when I was working down your neck of the woods, down in Devon, you know, where the the tin, the river tin, or the X or whatever, something would pour into it, and then you'd have all these thousands of dead fish and you know, seabirds and all sorts of things being affected. Did that ever sort of affect you?
I was more office and policy based. I was doing things like writing permits for major installations, some of which were just sort of starting up. I was working on monitoring air pollution from power stations, international trade in waste, and then some sort of editing publication sort of work as well. So I was jumping around a bit. I wasn't an inspector actually going out and clearing up the mess, but I was working behind the scenes enabling people to do that. But you know, one thing I do remember is going on a trip to Sweden back in the early 80s, and there was this beautifully pristine lake in the middle of the forest, and it was totally dead. And it was totally dead because of the acid emissions from power stations in Britain and Germany blowing over to Sweden and falling in the lakes and killing the fish, basically, which is quite eerie, because you think something like that, you know, beautiful, pristine conditions would be teeming with life, but no, dead as a doornail.
Wow. Mm. And in terms of, you know, clearly science is a motivation, but also that concern for the environment, what percentage was your motivation in going into that industry and that side of, you know, the regulation side of things?
Well, it was television originally, which probably strikes a chord with you, Adrian. Round about 1969-70, there was a TV documentary called Due to Lack of Interest, Tomorrow Has Been Cancelled. Well, disregarding the grammatical error, that was a terrifying documentary. And I could see that, you know, we were heading for a resource crisis, a pollution crisis. And this was before there was anything said much about acid rain or climate change, or indeed the ozone layer. But there was just this tremendous upsurge in pollution. So I joined Friends of the Earth, which at the time was sort of fairly embryonic, ended up working in the Bristol office, was one of the first people to work locally in the regions, pursuing environmental campaigning. I did start doing a chemistry degree at Bristol, but left to work in Bristol for Friends of the Earth, and eventually went back. I did a biology teaching certificate and then an OU degree. And the thing which I liked about the OU is that the courses were very relevant. They were not sort of sterile ivory tower stuff. They were very much about, well, a course in organic chemistry was actually looking at the problems of lead in petrol and the damage it was doing, which most conventional university courses probably weren't at the time. So everything there had a very strong environmental bias. I got a degree, I did various other jobs as an environmental consultant when I left the pharmacy where I was analyzing drugs. And one of the things I did was to go around the country in a van borrowed from British Leyland, collecting playground dust and analyzing it for lead.
Wow.
One of the factors which helped get lead out of petrol in the UK. It was led by a very amazing campaigner called Des Wilson, who was behind Shelter, among other things, in the 60s. And one of the issues was I did, but there were plenty of other people involved, and the health aspects were brought to the fore as well. But it was a small part in getting lead out of petrol. So I've been very much concerned about the environment ever since I was 18. And there we go. You know, I got the job in the Environment Agency, having taught environmental type courses for the OU for a long time. When these jobs came up, I thought, yeah, that's where I want to be. And had a great time. I mean, I think it's changed a lot over the years. The complexion of the government has changed, whereas in the past, the chairman could say, no, you mustn't build another runway at Heathrow because it would cause so much air pollution that you'd be way over any kind of legal limit. Nowadays, they can't make any kind of public statement about what's wrong with government policy. They just have to sort of do as they're told. And they're moving to a new environment bill, which looks as though it will be something of a travesty. It's not good. They are making noises about climate change. Whether the Prime Minister will live up to his word, there's a good idea, is what remains to be seen. But we do have the climate change conference in Glasgow coming up, and we'll see whether they can actually put into force some of the rhetoric which they've been bandying around.
And I read this week that is it Algeria? It's the last country to have leaded petrol. This it was banned this week or something, I think, in the world.
I didn't see that, but I do know that the company which was making it in Britain was involved in a scandal where it was bribing the government of another country to allow it to still sell leaded petrol.
That's yeah. Business-y. And I remember when I was, my first car was a Triumph 2000 built in the early 70s, chocolate brown. And of course I had to go around finding leaded petrol for this old, my grandmother's old car. Then, of course, I did something stupid and drove into the back of some static traffic on London Bridge, and the car was no more. But I think in the longer term, the environment benefits, even if the five vehicles I smashed.
That's called a happy accident.
Yeah, there are things you could have done. You could have the valve seats hardened, which prolong the life of the engine under unleaded petrol. And you can get a higher octane petrol, which is just refined a bit more. For those older cars or specialist cars which need something with a bit more oomph. But no car needs to run on leaded petrol, except perhaps some very antique jobs, which they're not going to be around.
No, indeed. You know, but I mourn that car.
My first car was a Ford Fiesta van, and it ran on unleaded petrol. But I am 2 years younger than you.
Yeah, but you learned to drive a little bit quicker than I did. It's interesting. I mean, that environmental awareness period, when it sort of became a thing in that late 60s, early 70s. It's funny because I've just been watching a John Pertwee Doctor Who story, The Green Death, which is set in the mines of South Wales. And they're talking about petrochemical pollution and you know the green maggots and all this sort of thing running around.
Was that the one where they have but a it's really, on really, string being pulled towards him?
Yeah, it's a fantastically prescient tale, isn't
it?
You know, it's wonderful how, I mean, you know, they took risks in those days. I mean, nowadays, of course, Doctor Who, every single story is sort of trying to ram something down your throat. But on this occasion, it did it with a great deal of... a great deal of subtlety, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they made it different enough so you couldn't directly relate to it, but there was a relationship.
Well, they had the debate. I mean, the fact is, the people who are doing the pollution at least are acknowledging, you know, there is an effort to acknowledge that they're trying to do something about it, and unless it's the really, really bad guys at the top. But no, it's an interesting timepiece, really. Let's move on back to Fatal Trade then, and. You know, you're inspired by your top first line and filling it out. But how long has that process taken from submitting that first line, winning that competition, to the point where we are now with the publication of the book?
Difficult to be precise. I mean, I think the competition was at the end of November 2019. And I started some writing not too long afterwards. I got a draft by the spring of 2020, I think. I sent it off for a critique through Crime Fiction Coach, who and Louise Voss, who gave a nice quote for the cover, made some really helpful suggestions about how to improve things like characters and so on. So I took those on board. My wife read it, and she's incredibly helpful. She's got a very good eye for detail, very supportive, and also knows when something's going to work or not. So she went through it, and then I revised it. And I think it was around about June I started submitting it to people. I think I sent it to you around about the autumn of 20.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And at that point, it had been through various revisions, and you liked it.
We did.
Much to my delight.
No, we were hooked. And that's always a good sign for us because, as you know, when we read a submission, we read it separately. And if Rebecca's got to it first, she has a twinkle in her eye. when she presses the manuscript into my hand and goes,
I always say to you,
I'm not going to say anything, but I think you should read this, is what she says, which is usually a sign of, you know, we should be thinking about signing whoever it is. So
but it's really difficult not to give anything away, though, especially if I'm really keen for you to read it.
Absolutely. Mind you, you're still upset with me that I gave away one of the the key developments in The Chemist, which you're proofreading and I've just read through.
Yeah, so he does this. You do this quite a lot, actually. If we're both if we're both reading a submission or we're editing or proofreading in one of our books, he'll just say, oh, near the end, this happens. And I say, well, I haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What a killjoy I am. But no, in terms of that process then, I mean, Louise Voss obviously was a key figure in developing your craft. What areas did you work harder at, perhaps, when you were writing the novel? What came naturally, and what were the things that were a little harder?
I suppose character was the area I had most difficulty with. I think the plot, to some extent, I would say it wrote itself. I think that's a bit over-egging it. I mean, I had various ideas about what might happen, and they fitted together. And then something happened, you think, well, you know, what's going to happen next? So we had the issue with the threat from the head in the box. Well, that didn't have any effect on the person threatened. So what did the villains do next? How did they take that further? And if this failed, what would they do then? And who was behind it? And then I had to think, well, you know, there must be something more going on in the background. Then there was the parallel plot about the woman in the prologue coming down to seek revenge on somebody. How did she get near to the person she was targeting? How did she make the transition from someone who'd been trafficked and abused to someone who was really powerful and knew what she was doing? And they seem to follow more or less naturally, but then you sort of put in embellishments to show how, you know, how is she so competent? What did she do when she had to take action against somebody? Little bits like that fill in. But making the characters more than just, I suppose, ciphers was a bit tricky. I decided quite early on that Mel Cotton would have a dark sense of humour. So, you know, at one point when they're looking for going off to talk to somebody, she says, well, I'll head off there. So that, again, that's a sort of gallows humor which we talked about earlier. So it was a question of getting the story down and then going back and saying, well, how can I make this person more human? So I gave one of the characters a newborn baby. His wife had the newborn baby, and he was constantly coming in smelling of baby sick and so on. another one who had a vintage car, which plays a minor part in one of the incidents. And then somebody else who's got a crush on Mel Cotton. And where's that going to go? Where does that develop? So yes, it was a question of sort of fitting in there. Then why have you got a DI running an investigation? There must be a reason for that, because something like this would normally be run by a DCI. So I worked out a reason for that. And that again has repercussions throughout the other parts of the book. So I guess working hardest was on the people side, the technical bits and the, you know, the firearm stuff, and that was not difficult. The way the story developed was okay. I mean, I did realize at one point that there was a little bit more substance needed, and something a bit more original, which is why I put in the source of income, which was a little bit more than would be expected from some run-of-the-mill drug dealers, which I won't want to spoil.
No.
Yeah, definitely a spoiler flag going up at this point.
Yeah. And then I fitted that in, and that led to a bit of character development for one of the other people. So it kind of, eventually the jigsaw was more or less assembled, and then, you know, people commented. Oh, I was supposed to be more conflict. Someone said I should put in more conflict. So I introduced a rather unpleasant character who created a bit of a stir in the local police station and generally made a nuisance of himself.
Perfect. No, I mean, you know, naturally the characters are very strong and that come through. So clearly that process works. What do you enjoy most about putting something like this together and writing a book like this? What was the what were the areas where you found, you know, the real pleasure?
Getting a plot which works, and just having things running along, ticking over nicely, and then chucking in the odd bit of either humour and a bit of humanity, because there are, I don't want to give away any particular scenes, but there are one or two lines I've put in, which I'm really quite pleased about, where someone says something, or there's a kind of minor incident, or even possibly a fairly major incident, which in some cases, I suppose, might reflect my views, because I think it's difficult for a writer to not let some of their own feelings get through into a book. And when it all seems to fit together and work, and I suppose what you always have to do, of course, is to set the manuscript aside for a while, and then come back to it a few days later. And I make a point of sitting in a different room to read hard copy of something, you know, before it's ready to go off. And if I read through it, I think, yeah, I'd read this, then that gives me enormous pleasure. If I think, oh, I'm bored as to hell with this, then I think, well, something's got to be done. But yeah, I think reading something which I think, well, if someone else had written it, I'd enjoy it, is probably a tremendous feeling.
That's good. Yeah. Well, what I was going to ask, I was just thinking about when you were answering that question, is do you read a lot of crime yourself? Does that feed into the way you write?
An enormous amount, yeah. I mean, apart from, I suppose, a time in the late 60s where I was reading a lot of fantasy and some sci-fi, some of it very good, things like Dune, some of it perhaps less so, some of the more dated sci-fi stuff, and some good fantasy as well. And obviously, one has to speak up for Terry Pratchett, who I didn't come into until about the 80s, I think, who was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I've read crime novels ever since I was about 10, starting with Leslie Charteris's Saint books. And I read Golden Age stuff. I read some of the sort of grittier thrillers. I like people like Mike Craven, David Mark, Paul Finch. For police procedurals, there's Lee Russell, Angela Marson's, Kate Rose's book set on the Scilly are wonderful because of those tremendous echoing of the place there, which is places I've been. So yeah, a huge range of crime stuff. And those, you know, not discriminating against other writers, those are writers who come to mind who I particularly like, but there are many more, you know. I've read Agatha Christie, I particularly like locked room mysteries, actually. John Dixon Carr was an expert at this, so I like a lot of those, and some of the modern ones which crop up too.
Mm. What about the phenomena surrounding TV crime at the moment, in the sense that I think we've talked about it before when we were negotiating, you know, your thoughts on Line of Duty, for instance, and how often to repeat a phrase, they jump the shark in the pursuit of drama.
Have you watched the submarine thing?
Have you watched Vigil on a Sunday night?
Not yet. With things like that, we tend to save them up and watch them in a sequence, although we didn't do that with Line of Duty because it was far too gripping. Line of Duty is, I think, one of the best crime dramas around. It's also completely unrealistic because the police don't investigate themselves. It's an independent unit. You wouldn't have people just popping in and out of going undercover like that. It's a highly trained thing. Some of the things they've done with firearms are quite ridiculous. But what the hell, it's so bloody good, you know?
Yeah,
the performances.
Watch it. Well, I did. You'd seen it before, hadn't you?
But, yeah.
There was one Sunday and he said, oh, let's watch Line of Duty from the start. And I hadn't seen it. And I think we watched it every night for 3 weeks and got through the whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, the performances from these people and the plotting is terrific. And, you know, I've seen Jed Mercurio speak and he's very good. I also liked his medical dramas. But no, it's a different police universe. But within that, it is superb. Other TV things, Traces was, it was originally on Alibi, but it's it turned up on BBC or ITV, I can't remember. One of the normal channels, anyway. Mm. It's a young forensic scientist, ostensibly in Dundee, getting mixed up with, you know, what happened to her parents and so on. That was forensically terrific, partly because it was co-written or involved with Val McDermid, and one of the pathologists who advises her, whose name I have very great difficulty in pronouncing, Nick MacDave or something, Irish name, works in England or Scotland, I think. And that was really first class in terms of forensic stuff. Silent witness, it started off as drivel. I mean, having someone of about 22 who's a forensic anthropologist carrying out PMs on, you know, Home Office PMs, which it didn't happen. It's got better. They've got the science better. And again, it's drama. Midsummer Murders is just entertainment. You just, the way they trample over a crime scene and pay no regard to police procedure. We watch them because they're fun, but we don't expect any kind of chiming with reality there.
No, that's fair enough. And to be fair, I mean, watching Vigil, I've been sort of scratching my head as to how big is this submarine in terms of the amount of room they seem to have to move around.
Well, it makes me want to go on one. I really want to go on a submarine.
No, trust me, you really do not. I mean, no, so, I mean, it's supposed to be the Vigilant class of submarines that they currently have carrying the nuclear deterrent. And yes, it's a vessel of what, 480 feet long and some 35, 40 feet wide. But, you know, the sets are huge.
Surely it's like being in here, being in a submarine.
Well, with a bit more sort of things to bang into. Because they've been interviewing submariners who've said, yeah, it's kind of a little bit, yeah, it's reminiscent. But the fact is there are many, many more things hanging off the walls. And suspended from the ceiling for you to bump into.
Well, actually, to me, it looks more like Star Trek, the set of Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah. Because no one's actually seen, outside of being a submariner, no one's actually seen inside these submarines. It's all closely guarded secret, so they're having to sort of make it up on the fly. But that's my number one concern with the story so far. But, you know, I'll look forward to that conversation over a pint, Brian.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, we'd like to know what you think when you get to it.
I don't know an awful lot about submarines myself, but I do know they're very cramped and every bit of space is used up because you want to make it as small as possible to avoid radar or ASDIC or whatever, and still cram as much kit as you need, which means that to work in one of those and spend months sort of under the sea, you have to be a very special sort of sailor to do it.
Absolutely. No, I had a few years ago, I went to see HMS Ocelot, which is a 1960s hunter-killer submarine, or actually was used for covert operations. And, you know, it's not dissimilar to what you see in the preserve U-boats. I mean, you know, really very tight conditions. And this sort of all pervasive, even over the years, and I'm sure they cleared it up, smell of stale sweat from you know, submariners. It's not a comfortable experience. Anyway, we've digressed into the world of Vigil. So are there any times when, I mean, it's interesting you say you can compartmentalize and see it for what it is, as entertainment, because when I watch news programs, which is, you know, obviously my working background, I can't help but scream at the television when I see them falling into the cliche traps of the sort of shots they use on certain types of story. I mean, for instance, there's no business report the BBC have ever done in the last 15 years that hasn't had the graphic of the banknotes dropping from the ceiling floated over some footage. They do this on every single thing. It makes me swear. I don't know how you can, given your scientific interest and knowledge, you know, when you see it going awry, you can't, you know, you can still enjoy it for entertainment, because I can't.
Well, I don't think the news is entertaining, is it?
No, not often.
I think it's what you're expecting. I think there are plenty of occasions where I've seen someone say, well, why didn't they ask me? I could have told them how to get that right. but some people do a lot of work. I mean, watching The Bridge, which again, it's terrific acting and the portrayal of Sagar Noren is, I suppose, world-class acting, whatever you look at. I've no idea how normal police procedure works in Sweden and Denmark, so I just have to take that at face value. They do make some mistakes on some of the science, on the toxicology, but at least they're looking at something different from the usual sort of arsenic cyanide kind of things. I think you have to be a bit detached. And if you talk to people like Graham Barklett on police procedure, they have to take shortcuts, because if they followed it like an ordinary police investigation, you'd have hours and hours of people looking up stuff on computers, riffling through papers, filling out forms, applying for overtime and doing all kinds of stuff, which is remotely completely undramatic. So they have to take shortcuts. Same with toxicology results. You know, you can take weeks to get some of the more obscure things back from the lab. They have to telescope it, but where you get something like a corpse is found at 10 o'clock, the PM's done at lunchtime, and they've got all the toxicology back by tea time, you think, well, no, it could be a bit more realistic on that.
True enough. It's interesting. I think there is a movement within British crime fiction writing to get that those elements right. I mean, I'm now reading a lot more, oh, well, we won't see those results for 2 weeks. Well, in the meantime, what are we going to do? I think, but that wouldn't happen in television with the, or indeed film, where, you know, everything has to be condensed anyway. And it's all a shorthand.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, interestingly, science is catching up with this to some extent, because you know, going back, I know, 7 or 8 years, you'd be waiting for perhaps a week for DNA samples to be processed and the results to come back. Then it came down to sort of 48 hours. They now have machines which they're developing, which can give you a result in 2 hours. Now, it might not be good enough for evidence in court, but if you're looking to exonerate someone or follow up a suspicion, then you've got some evidence there which you've got grounds for arrest at least. So science is catching up a bit, but it's still going to take a hell of a long time to find traces of aconite in someone's sandwich which they've eaten three hours ago, that kind of thing.
It's awesome, isn't it? I mean, in terms of keeping abreast of all these developments and the new technology and the way that that's affecting procedure, clearly you mentioned Graham Bartley, who's a friend of the show, obviously, and has worked with a number of our authors. Indeed, you know, is a sort of stalwart of the entire community, really. But in terms of keeping your knowledge up to date, how do you do that?
Browsing into the scientific literature sometimes, keeping an eye on the papers, and then following up stories which appear. And I mean, I do quite a few inquiries from authors. And if they're asking about something, then I'll check that I've got the most up-to-date information before giving a response, because there's no point giving them something that's out of date, especially if it's going to be a year before their book actually comes out.
So in a sense, yeah, your knowledge and, you know, what you seek out is guided sometimes by the people who call on you.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Mike Craven asked me about the origin of the universe the other day. I did an astronomy course as part of an OU degree a long time ago, and I vaguely remember, but I certainly checked to make sure that I wasn't going to feed him something which was nonsense.
That's a big question.
That's a cheeky one, Mike.
Well, it's like a Rebecca's random question.
I don't want to give it away, but you probably know he has a character called Tilly, who's scientific genius and so on, and there is some dialogue coming up where she's talking about what existed just after the Big Bang, and he asked me to check something, and I did.
Brilliant.
Now that actually leads to my random question, interestingly enough.
Are we ready for it?
I don't know.
Okay, shall I give you the big build-up?
It is related to the Big Bang.
It's time for this week's Rebecca's random question.
Do you believe there is life beyond Earth?
Yeah, but, you know, Jim, not as we know it, as the saying goes. I think the statistics are there. There are so many planets and so many galaxies that for this to be the only planet where there is life of some sort of sort is, you know, just stretching the bounds of credibility. There must be some sort of life out in other places. Whether it's anything like what we can see at the moment on this planet, anybody's guess. It's evolution could go in all sorts of different directions. I think it'd probably be based on carbon, but I mean, I'm not enough of an evolutionary chemist to be able to say that. Maybe there could be silicon-based life forms under different planetary conditions. I don't know. But there are bound to be other planets out there which fit into what they call the Goldilocks zone. You're not too hot, not too cold, for life of some sort to develop. But what it would look like, you know, it's probably not going to look like Klingons in Star Trek or any of the other sort of sci-fi.
Or tribbles,
yeah. Or Triffids or whatever, yeah.
Oh, Triffids, now we're talking.
No, I love Tribbles. I want there to be Tribbles somewhere.
Really?
Yeah, they're cute.
Well, I look at daffodils and think triffids every time I see them. Just baby ones.
I definitely believe that there's life beyond the earth, because I just, you know, similar reasons. And also,
yeah,
we can't possibly know, because we can't go beyond a certain distance in our lifetime.
Well, it won't surprise you to learn that I did ask a certain very famous professor when...
Oh, him.
This is before he gave up on me as a pathetic intellectual specimen. Stephen Hawking. Wow. So many, many, many years ago, I briefly dated his daughter when she was in her teens. We were in our teens. And I did ask him that question, and I got a very lengthy answer, which takes a long time for him to program. So we sort of waited half an hour.
He should be quite flattered then. He had the time.
So. Yeah, he did. And then he called me all sorts of things after that. yeah, I won't do the voice. One day I will.
After... Well, bloody Scotland, you've promised.
Oh, yeah. Get drunk in the bar and do my...
Now you sound like Michael Caine.
Yeah, I will speak like Michael Caine. No, yeah, that's the other thing I'd do when I'm drunk. No, I mean... he was pretty convinced, but he couldn't scientifically sort of put his name on it.
A friend of mine claims her sister has met an alien. She lives in Brazil.
Right.
And she said that the spaceship parked outside the house.
Yeah.
Or sort of hovered outside
the house. I'm loving this.
And her sister was a child, sort of 8-9 years old, and she looked out the window and she could see through a window in this craft of some sort, a creature staring at her.
Right.
And then it disappeared.
Wow.
And she swears it's true. She absolutely swears it's true.
She wasn't probed in any way or any orifice?
No, nothing like that.
Okay, fair enough.
Probably a CIA helicopter.
Could be. Especially in Brazil, mind you, I mean, there's all sorts of things.
If you've got this sort of large craft hovering outside the house, it's going to be exerting quite a lot of force and dissipating energy, keeping it hovering. So why didn't the house fall down?
Well, yeah, but you're putting the laws of physics as we know them on the
situation. But you cannot change the laws of physics.
Yeah. Well said.
They might have different laws of physics on a different planet.
What, in Brazil?
Not in Brazil, no. Portuguese laws of physics. No, I don't think that.
I mean, there's a lot of random things that happen in Brazil. And I have to say, having been on the beaches of Rio on several occasions, thanks to sporting events, I must admit that gravity seems to play a very strange part
in
some of the things you see there.
What way?
I've seen that film with Michael.
Well, I leave it to the imagination.
But I need a little bit to go on.
Okay, things hanging out that shouldn't and things staying in place that shouldn't.
You're talking about aliens again?
No, I'm talking about...
Oh, he's just mimed, so I've got it now.
Fine, good. How did we get to this? Well, let's get back to Brian's career rather than talking about aliens.
Well, that was a random question, so we had to go off on a tangent.
and, you know, ample cleavages and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, in terms of where... The characters you've created go next. Mm. Is there a Fatal Trade follow-up in the offing?
Yep, there is. What can I say without spoiling things? I mean, the major characters apart from the villains in Fatal Trade are very much present in the next one. I'm thinking vaguely of calling it Fatal Hate. It involves, among other things, racial violence and tension, people stirring things up, funded by illegal drugs importation. Okay, we've had drugs before, but they're pretty much everywhere. Mm. And there's also a very devious MP who people might consider to be an amalgamation of some of the characters which grace the House of Commons at the moment, but I'm not attributing them to any particular party because that would be too partisan, but people can form what conclusions they like. And he's involved in various unpleasant activities. And we've got a combination of, I suppose, police procedural stuff and some more exciting things happening as well. You know, people in peril, and Mel Cotton rises to the occasion again, as you'd expect. So yes, that's going through the review process for my wife at the moment, and should be ready to submit to you pretty soon.
Yay! Yay, I look forward to it.
I think we're now recognising that your wife is becoming the ultimate arbiter.
Can we send her all the Hobet manuscripts?
There's a few.
Yeah.
No, it sounds fantastic. Well, we're really looking forward to receiving that, and clearly, in the nearest future, being in a position to publish it too.
One of the sort of common comments of the Heart team who've read Fatal Trade is, can't wait for the next one.
Mm. Well, I don't want to keep them waiting, do I?
You've got to do it for your public.
Yeah, crack on. In terms of, as we draw this interview to a close, how do you think you'll feel that day that it, you know, when it finally emerges, as you know, a day from now, from
a week
where
tomorrow,
a week tomorrow, I beg your pardon, yeah, when we're publishing this podcast?
Well, really excited, obviously, to move into the fiction field, which was different for me. I mean, when you're writing science, which effectively I'd done before, you want nice, clean, linear development of a concept from sort of basics into something a bit more complicated, taking things which can be fairly abstruse in some cases and making them intelligible to people who are, well, not daft, but don't have a scientific background. And of course, many writers have an English literature background, so wouldn't have come across some of the scientific ideas which you need to perhaps have a nodding acquaintance with for some of these things. So writing in that sort of sense is fairly straightforward. You do your research, you make sure you know what you're talking about, you get it down in understandable English. With fiction, it's got to come from your imagination. Yes, you've got to create, in my case, I create a new town where all the action takes place. You create characters who don't exist, although there's all these occasional references, and everything that happens comes from your own head. And to see that process being appreciated by the people in the Heart Readers team and others who've looked at it is absolutely thrilling. So when it's actually there, and hopefully in the local Waterstones, I'll be really tremendously excited.
Yeah, we can't wait. Congratulations on Fatal Trade and for the future. And thank you for being part of our Hobet family. We're extremely grateful.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for this interview. We've learned a lot.
Yeah, I know. No, it's got me thinking about aliens.
Don't talk to any strange aliens.
Brian, thanks so much.
Okay, cheers.
Wonderful to speak to Brian Price. Congratulations on Fatal Trade. And that is available the day after this podcast goes live.
And Brian, again, like all previous interviewees that we've spoken to, coped very well with my random question. Well done, Brian.
Yep, absolutely. Now, next week, we're going to be throwing a load of random questions, I imagine.
I think I've got to think of quite a few questions, haven't I? Because we're hoping to be talking to quite a few people.
Well, we're going to bloody Scotland.
Scotland is a beautiful country. How dare you?
The festival, not the country itself. We're going to Stirling for bloody Scotland. We talked about it for a bit. We've got Mark Whiteman in line for the debut prize for best Scottish crime debut of the year.
And we're going to get to meet Mark for the first time too, so that's quite exciting.
Yeah, we met Ollie for the first time today as well, Ollie Jarvis. So we're gradually getting round to the list of authors.
And giving them all a mug each.
Absolutely. We've had our mugs before you know it. So we'll be at Bloody Scotland, and the who's who, of course, of Scottish crime fiction writing will be there. Our esteemed friend Ian Rankin amongst them, but we hope to grab Val McDermott for a chat as well, and the many other wonderful names there. We're also going to be seeing Tina Baker, who has moved from working as an expert on many things in the media through to being a personal trainer and now a crime novelist as well. And so we're looking forward to meeting her.
Soap to blood,
yeah. She she'll be a lot of fun. So one of our guests to come on the Hopcast.
She's agreed to talk to us, hasn't she? So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I used to see her around a bit at Five Live back in the day, but never had the courage to speak to her because she always seemed so confident. But she confided in me that actually that's very much a front and that she's quite a private person, really. And I kind of understand that because I can perform, doing this podcast, a performance in many ways, but withdraw
Yeah, and you know, I'm similar, but not quite. I'm not quite as good at performing as you, but I do relate to that. And I was saying to you earlier today that when we went to see Ollie, you know, you were very able to talk very eloquently and intelligently about all sorts of subjects. But I know that, you know, you also need that sort of period after doing something like when you just need to sort of reflect and withdraw. And
yeah, not so easy. It's been another busy week. I finished proofreading Linda Huber's latest book, Pact of Silence. Loved it. And that will be out before very long. Also been working in the audio studio on Malcolm Hollingdrake's Catch as Catch Can, trying to polish up my Merseyside accents.
And we've been watching episodes of Brookside to help you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Harry Enfield sketches of the Scousers. Calm down.
I'm not,
yeah,
I don't calm down.
No, it's not really what we want for that. And also working on one or two other little bits of project in there as well. Just getting the studio bedded down, and it's really valuable resource now to be able to go and work whenever I can.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, yeah, you can now sort of chop and change between Hoebeck work and audio work, and I think it's making you more productive in a strange way, you know.
Yeah, I like to be able to chop and change.
Yeah, you are a chop and changer.
Yeah, you know, I'll put in 2-3 hours of good concentration and then I'll need to do something else.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I mean, I've been editing The Chemist, which I'm thoroughly enjoying, I have to say, Lewis. So, you know, it's... but I can only do an hour or two at a time because it's such a high level of concentration when you're editing a book, because you are looking for anything you can find, any missing comma, any extra space or anything like that, as well as reading for sense at more than 2 hours, and I would not be so effective.
No, that's tough. The kids have gone back to school, which has been, you know, mixed blessing, because they're coming home knackered and grumpy and hungry. But, you know, they're back, and that'll settle down into a rhythm in the second week, I'm sure.
Yeah. And they're all at the same school now, so it's much easier for me. I just park the car and throw them out.
Yeah, indeed. So we've got a busy week. We've got quite a lot of work to do with our new marketing partner in Matthew J. Holmes, who was on the programme a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, he was.
Sue Shepherd's Swindles is now out, if you haven't got it already. It's getting great reviews.
Oh yeah,
selling
it's
well,
really,
and
pleasing.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone loves to hate Vincent, or hates to love Vincent. I mean, one of the two. Anyway, it's that's very gratifying. But we continue to work hard at Hoebeck Books. Check out our website, www.hoebeck.net, where you can find out all the details of all our authors, all of our books, get discounted paperbacks, and generally get involved in our world. We are still open for submissions, dare I say it. We've had a mountain of submissions so far.
Yeah, so even today, while we've been out, I think we've had 2 today, so I think that makes 28 in September.
That's quite a few to listen, to read through, so, you know, bear with us.
Yeah, I was going to say, bear with us. You know, I always respond straight away just to say, I've got your submission, but, you know, it's going to take us a little while to read through them.
It's we're always going to get some noises off when we're standing on a bridge like this to remind you where we are. We're at Knutsford service station, overlooking the traffic below, reliving your youth a little bit.
It is reliving my youth, because so my dad's idea of a good day out on a Saturday afternoon, we had 3 kids to entertain, he would take us to either this services or Keel services to stand on the bridge. Keel services, they've got fruit machines on the bridge, or they did in the 70s anyway. And so he'd give us all 30p each to spend on the fruit machines.
Oh, you lived.
And
brilliant.
We watched the cars for an hour.
Yeah, I'd be taking them on a Sunday afternoon to watch King's College Choir sing Evensong. Slightly different upbringing. But anyway, there we go. So... it just remains for us to say we'll join you from Scotland next week. Thanks again to our guest this week, Brian Price. But we really hope you have a wonderful creative week. And thank you for joining us on The Hobcast.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoebeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hoebeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoebeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast, and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.